This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura. He has some thoughts about American politics. He's not happy at all about the way things are going with the Democratic or the Republican parties. We'll find out why from Governor Ventura. Also on the show, John McGinnis. He just finished his 40th regular session covering Louisiana politics, and last night the session ended with somewhat of a whimper. Started in a big way with Governor Jindal asking for the abolition of the income tax in Louisiana. That went absolutely nowhere. We'll talk with John McGinnis about what was and wasn't accomplished in the 2013 regular session. Bob Lutz, former vice chair of General Motors, his book is Icons and Idiots. Wait till you hear what he has to say about Lee Iacocca. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Thanks to Bob Mann for a great job the past couple of days. And we're back in the saddle for today with Governor Jesse Ventura to start. The man who led the state of Minnesota from 1999 to 2003, former wrestler, former Navy SEAL, a man who's had probably the most varied life of anyone in the United States who is living today. His latest book, he's been a best-selling author as well, Democrips and Democrips and Republicans, No More Gangs in Government. It's available in paperback and by ebook. And Governor Ventura is here to talk with us about our country and the world at large, and he's a man who's seen the world, actually spends much of his time in Mexico, but joining us today in Minnesota. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning, Jim. How are you today? And hello to all my friends down in Cajun country.
It's always good to talk with Governor Jesse Ventura. Now, you spend, about 8 months right now in Minnesota and 4 months in Mexico, and you don't fly. So that's quite a drive when you go from one place to the other, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 3,000 miles one way, and it takes roughly about 5 days to do it, Jim, but that's part of the adventure. See, I won't put up with the Gestapo airports anymore. I refuse to fly. I have not flown now for well over 3 years. I have metal in my body, so when I go to the airport, I'm treated like a criminal. And I don't particularly like to be treated like a criminal. There's no alternative. I tried to go to court on it. They threw it out of court. The federal judge, I sued under the Fourth Amendment, and the federal judge said she didn't have jurisdiction. And then we later found out that you can't bring a lawsuit against TSA or Homeland Security because that's what they do. They throw them all out of court.
Well, it must be an experience right now when you're on the border between the U.S. and Mexico.
Oh, yeah, it's an experience, all right, depending which way you're going. If you're coming into the United States, it's like trying to get into East Berlin. It's like Checkpoint Charlie. The only thing missing are the army tanks. And if you're going the other way into Mexico, there's generally nobody there. I've actually driven across the border, stopped my car at the border of U.S. going into Mexico and looked around and said, doesn't anyone say buenos dias and at least hand you a piece of paper? It seems more free down there than it does here when you cross the border.
Well, when
you put it that way,
when you're trying to get back into the United States from your home in Mexico, what happens then? Even to a former governor, former mayor, decorated Navy SEAL, and all around nice guy,
it's horrible. You spend at least 3 hours in 5 to 6 lanes of traffic. It takes you that long to cross. It's like trying to get into East Berlin. And now they even have these immigration stops 2 hours after you're driving the highways of Arizona out in the middle of the Arizona desert. You'll come to sometimes an hour and a half stop where they're checking immigration, which is unconstitutional. You've already showed your passport at the border, and you're not required to have to prove that you're a citizen. At least you didn't used to, of course, according to the Constitution. But let's remember, Jim, our government today really ignores the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. I think the latest news stuff on all this wiretapping and putting everyone under surveillance, if they're not clear on that, you know, clearly now the Fourth Amendment doesn't exist. The Second Amendment is being destroyed. And the First Amendment was pretty well destroyed with the Wall Street protesters when they ran them off with pepper spray and dogs.
Well, what do you make of this revelation that Americans are being spied upon, that the government has access to our phone records, and if you're a reporter, no telling what's going on as far as the government looking into what your life is like?
Well, it shows us the age of technology. I guess it shows us that George Orwell was not wrong when he wrote the book 1984 and all that. It just, he was a few years behind. But it's very concerning to me. I mean, we're supposed to be the country of freedom, and I think we've lost sight of the fact that the government's supposed to work for us. Now, how does it work when, since we're the employer, we pay the bills, and they're the employee? How is it that the employee can spy upon the employer?
Well,
I don't get that. I mean, why is our tax dollars used to spy upon us?
Well, Lindsey Graham,
I think that's a gross misuse of our money. I think that it violates everything concerning the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and it violates its, it shows clearly what's next, martial law.
Well, the senator from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, yesterday said it's necessary to combat terrorism. Do you buy that?
Give me a break. This is as phony as the war on drugs. Terrorism can be combated by good police work, intelligence gathering, and you don't have to spy. What? In other words, Lindsey Graham saying that we're all potential terrorists? That's what he's saying, because they're spying on us. So Senator Graham, in essence, then is saying, you people are all potential terrorists, and we need to keep an eye on you.
That is what he's saying.
Yeah. I take offense to that. Excuse me, Senator. I served in the United States Navy 6 years. I've been a mayor. I've been a governor. I've paid my taxes for 40 years. How dare you? That's what I say to him. How dare you accuse me of being a terrorist?
Democrats and Republicans, No More Gangs in Government, the best-selling book from Jesse Ventura, and he's got another one coming out October 1st, and we'll talk with him about that one as well, but he's had some aversion to what's going on in Washington and around our country with our government leaders for some time, and he was governor and mayor of the fifth largest city in the state of Minnesota. He knows what he's talking about when it's government from an insider's point of view. Did you like being governor?
Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful. I mean, you're the most powerful man in the state. You know, I guess the old quote, it's good to be king. But no, naturally, no, it had challenges. It was a life experience that I chalk up to. It was tremendous. But it also made me have to live amongst Democrats and Republicans and career politicians. So after about 4 years, I feel like I need to take a shower, and that's one reason you always see I don't seek re-election. I just do one term. Or that's my record. I did one term as mayor. I certainly could have been reelected, and I did one term as governor, and there's no doubt I would have been reelected there if I'd have wanted to. But to me, it's like by that point of, well, and the reason I say that, Jim, is that the Democrats and Republicans have created a system based completely upon bribery. Now, bribery in the private sector is against the law. We go to jail for it. In the public sector, that's how you spend $1 billion to become president, is through bribery. Now, to last in a system like this of, say, 15, 20 years getting elected from one office to another, you must be comfortable with bribery, which to me means you got a good criminal element in you to begin with. So these Democrats and Republicans, they are comfortable with bribery. They've created a system of it. And so obviously they have a criminal element to them. So they are very much like the street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, thus the title of my book.
Now, in the past, we've had you on this program, and you've talked about the so-called chicken hawks. The other day I got an email from a nice gentleman who took offense to me taking aim at former Vice President Cheney and others for not serving in Vietnam and asking me if I served. Well, I was born in 1958, so the war ended when I was in high school. I like to think that I would have done what Jesse Ventura would have done. I might not have come back if I had gone over there as a Navy SEAL, but But Dick Cheney and others, who are the biggest advocates of war of their generation, they did not serve. Is that an issue?
Well, it's certainly something to look at. Let me give you this perspective, Jim. Look at everybody who's had huge followings for peace in our last century. People that stood for peace against war and nonviolence all had violent death. President Kennedy, Senator Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, when he returned from Mecca, a changed man, and John Lennon. They all were murdered, and yet they stood for peace. And yet the war people, they all seem to survive real well. You know, if you stand for war, I guess you got... That's what troubles me. We've been at war my entire life, if you count the war on drugs, which is indeed a war. Go talk to the 20,000 to 30,000 Mexicans who have died. You know, I mean, you count that, we've been at perennial war my whole life. And I've made the statement, if I were to become president, I would... Now I'm going to make you do your homework. I would have the foreign policy, and I would follow the teachings of Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. And General Butler was a U.S. Marine, and he wrote the most anti-war book you've ever read. It's called War is a Racket. And the reason no one can criticize General Butler is because he won not one, but two Congressional Medals of Honor.
And, yeah,
and
those
he wrote the most anti-war book. Get it? It's called War is a Racket, Major General Smedley Darlington Butler. And he made the statement. He served about 100 years ago, and he made the statement, I didn't serve the American people. I served the United Fruit Corporation. When they would go into Central and South America, if they didn't get cooperation, they'd send in the U.S. Marines to get it.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Governor Ventura. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Governor, do you think that our constant state of war might in some way be attributable to the armaments industry and the influence that their lobbyists have in Washington?
Oh, most definitely. I have to laugh. The government now wants to take away our Second Amendment, our right to own guns or even assault weapons and all that. Yet why don't they set the example? Our government sells more arms throughout the world than anybody. So it's okay for someone in a foreign country to own an assault weapon, but it's not okay for me? I don't get it. And that's my point. If the government wants to disarm us, then they should disarm themselves. They should stop being the seller of weapons throughout the world. And let me add this on that issue. Look at history in the last 100 years. Every place, there's been about 6 major genocides committed where government has killed masses of their people. Every one of them was where they practiced gun control. The people had no way to defend themselves. That's what the Second Amendment is about. It's so we, the people, have the ability to stand up and defend ourselves if our government becomes abusive. And for those that think that that's a lost cause, let me remind you that in the country of Vietnam, they had no Navy, they had no Air Force, they were just a bunch of rice farmers with AK-47s, but they withstood more ordnance than what we dropped in World War II.
Nicholas in Sherwood, you're on with Governor Ventura. Hi, Nicholas.
Hey, good morning. Governor, always enjoy hearing your takes. I thought it might be a good time to ask you your opinion on the IRS at the moment.
Well, first of all, I'll give you my opinion. We could abolish the IRS if we would abolish the income tax and go to a national sales tax, which is something that I've been advocating now for over 20 years. You could set a national sales tax and you could charge 12% of our gross national product, basically. And if they can't run the government off 12% of our gross national product, well, then it's time to rebuild and retool the entire government. And by going to a national sales tax, you would never have to face an audit again. The IRS, you could reverse their role. Instead of the IRS watching you, the citizens, you turn them around and make them watch the government to make sure that the government spends our money properly.
We'll be back in 90 seconds with Governor Ventura.
Well, that's a-
This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF, and we've got Governor Jesse Ventura with us for a bit longer. He was governor of Minnesota 1999 to 2003, prior to that mayor of Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, fifth largest city in the great state of Minnesota, where the governor is joining us today. His best-selling book, Democrips and Republicans, now available in paperback and by ebook, and soon, coming October 1st, and we'll talk with Governor Ventura about this in a few moments, They Killed Our President, 63 Facts That Prove a Conspiracy to Kill JFK. Jason writes, do you think there's any chance for an average citizen to run for public office and be able to have an actual effect on policy if they're elected? Governor?
Certainly. That's the American way. I've already thrown the gauntlet down and said that if there was a grassroots movement that got me ballot access in all 50 states, and if they could guarantee I could debate, get in the debates, because you got to be in the debates to win. If they cut you out of the debates, you have no chance. And they determine that, the Democrats and Republicans, of course. But I said if the people would do that, two things, I would give it serious consideration, and here would be my platform. I would run to allow the people of the United States the opportunity to elect their first president since George Washington, the father of our country, who does not belong to a political party and is not owned by corporate special interest or lobbyists.
Laura asks, do you think physical appearance, is important when people are running for president of the United States?
Certainly, I guess it is. It should not be. But, yeah, you better have a haircut. You better, look a certain way and all that stuff. I don't know why, because it doesn't change the person that you are. The person you are is not necessarily your physical appearance. But, you have to do that. So watch out for me, because I still have my hair long. It's when I cut my hair that you got to be careful.
you're such an imposing physical specimen, though. I would think most people would not want to be on the same stage with you debating you.
Well, that's what I like. See, when I ran for governor, I always tried to be in the middle, because I wanted people to see that and have a psychological effect on them. I wanted them in the back of their minds to think this: if I were in a dark alley, which one of these three would I want with me?
Well, our governor, Bobby Jindal, he wants to be president, and I'm guessing he's about 5'9 and about 130, 35 pounds. Can a guy like that do it, independent of whether he's qualified?
Sure. All you got to do is have a presence on television, and they don't need to know how big you are. I mean, look at Sylvester Stallone. He's only about 5'8" at the top.
If that.
If that. And yet he's the heavyweight champion, Rocky Balboa. Now, how many heavyweight champs have you seen that are only 5'6" or 5'7"? Not too many.
No.
Muhammad Ali, I think, was 6'3".
He was. With a 78-inch reach, too.
Exactly. Yeah. But, on TV cameras and in that controlled environment, they can take a midget and make him a giant.
You were 12 years old when President Kennedy was killed.
That's
obviously had a big impact on your life, and that's the focus of your newest book coming out October 1st. What was your impression as a young man, 12 years old, I guess probably in the 7th grade, when JFK was blown away on November 22nd, 1963?
Well, like all children, we were sent home. I remember it like yesterday. We were sent back to our home rooms, and then when news of the president's death came, we were immediately told to go home. School was canceled. And they didn't cancel public schools much in Minnesota back when I went to school. In the entire 13 years I went to public school, they canceled one day because of weather. So that shows you how tough it is in the public schools in the old days in Minnesota. So I remember it, of course, but I didn't really get into it until I had been through the service and got back and went to a year of college, and I heard Mark Lane speak, and it was the first time I heard somebody voice a different opinion than the official story. And then when wrestling changed and we started flying everywhere instead of driving, it gives you a lot of dead time, so I started reading everything I could get on the Kennedy killing. And the reason I'm writing this book, Jim, is because It's for my own ego, too. I want to go down in history, and the only way I can do that officially is write a book about it. But I want people to know 100 years from now that the 38th governor of Minnesota, Jesse Ventura, did not believe the Warren Commission and did not believe his own government or the, quote, official story of who killed John F. Kennedy. And I felt the only way to do that was to write my own book on it.
So you're convinced there was a conspiracy?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. Anyone that studies it at all. I mean, did you know that Jack Ruby had known Lee Harvey Oswald since Oswald was a kid?
No, I didn't know that.
Yes. And that I learned from Judith Berry, who was Oswald's mistress right in your own New Orleans.
Yeah, I know her, and she's really out there, but you believe her.
Oh, she has the document. She isn't out there. This was a brilliant, genius woman who Dr. Ochsner down there connived into coming to work for them when they were attempting to create a fast-moving cancer to kill Fidel Castro. If you go back and read on this, the U.S. government was in bed, the CIA, with the mafia in attempts to kill Castro back then. It's all documented. It's all been talked about in hearings. It's known.
You've read
that they were doing that back then. And they were, with Dr. Ochsner, they were attempting to create and that's what Lee's job was to carry that virus or whatever it was down to Mexico City and then exchange it to a guy who was going to take it to Havana.
So you're familiar with the book Dr. Mary's Monkey?
Absolutely, I am.
Yeah, we've had that featured on this show a few times. Edward Haslam.
Oh yes, I've read that book. I think twice.
Well, when I say it's out there, it's that right now considered to be out of the mainstream. But you're telling me that 100 years from now, when people read Edward Haslam's book and Jesse Ventura's book, it'll be very mainstream, that you'll be right and most of the others will be wrong.
I don't know if we'll be right or wrong, Jim. I just wanted it on the record that Jesse Ventura does not believe the Warren Commission nor the, quote, official story. Remember this. When the government comes out with something, the official story, it has the proper name. It's generally there to protect officials. That's why it's called the official story.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been to the sniper's nest, the alleged sniper's nest,
yep.
Sixth floor of the School Book Depository, Dallas, Texas, Dealey Plaza. What's it look like from there as you look down where President Kennedy was riding in the limousine?
Well, first of all, there's a gigantic Texas oak tree in the way. You got to shoot through the tree. And it's huge. And I said to the curator, I said, well, obviously this was much smaller tree when Oswald was there. And he said, oh, no, this is a national monument. We keep everything as close to what it was as it can be. And I looked at him and said, you mean that tree was that big? And he goes, yes. I started laughing. I said, that right there, there's no way. How do you shoot through a tree with a piece of garbage weapon, which I tried to duplicate on my TV show, and you cannot work the bolt fast enough and get on target? They allege he did it in a little over 6 seconds, the fastest I could do it, and I was an expert with both pistol and rifle, and I even qualified expert still in rifle when I was governor of Minnesota at Camp Ripley. And you can't even get on. Carlos Hathcock, the former head of the Marine Corps Sniper School in Quantico, Virginia, they recreated the entire thing. And Carlos Hathcock, the greatest sniper in history, couldn't do it. And you're telling me a radarman? Oswald was a radarman. He wasn't even infantry. He didn't even carry a weapon during his Marine Corps service. He could outshoot the top sniper of the United States Marine Corps? I don't think so.
Do you think Kennedy was shot from the front, from the grassy knoll?
Absolutely, from the grassy knoll. I also spoke with Mr. Newman. Mr. Newman is in the Zapruder film covering his children up. He dove on him. He was physically the closest person to the fatal headshot, and the Warren Commission didn't even interview him. Wasn't even brought in for an interview. Because in his FBI report after the shooting, he said he felt the bullet came from over his right shoulder, which put it at the grassy knoll.
Well,
they didn't want to hear that. See, there's two cover-ups to Kennedy. There's the cover-up of the actual murder, and then there's the cover-up that took place afterwards. Both are as bad as each other.
Is there any new information that'll come forward on the 50th anniversary or after?
There's always new information that comes out. As documents keep getting released under the Freedom of Information Act and things of that nature, you're constantly getting more and more government documents that some do apply to Kennedy, and you can apply them there. There's some great books, JFK and the Unspeakable, the author's Douglas. He will tell you about a connection after the Cuban Missile Crisis between Kennedy and Khrushchev. They were back-channel communicating, and they were going to end the Cold War. They were doing it via Pope John in the Vatican. They were going to end the Cold War by 65, Khrushchev and Kennedy, and do a joint exploration of space together. Well, what happened? Pope John died of cancer. Kennedy was assassinated, and Khrushchev was taken out of power, and we had the Cold War for over 20 years.
Well, the book
there were forces that don't want peace out there, Jim.
Well, I'm with you.
Powerful forces that want us at perennial war all the time, which we've been doing.
The book is out October 1st. They Killed Our President: 63 Facts That Prove a Conspiracy to Kill JFK, from Governor Jesse Ventura. Let's take one more call for the governor. Please be brief, and then we'll let Governor Ventura get on to his next conversation. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on with Governor Ventura.
Yes, I definitely believe that there's no way that Lee Harvey Oswald could possibly make that shot like that with that crap of a rifle. And I believe that J. Edgar Hoover knew who did it and kept it quiet. Thanks.
Well, J. Edgar Hoover most definitely covered it up, because he actually sent a memo 24 hours after the killing stating that Oswald did it, and that was the only thing to investigate. Now, how the hell would... First of all, it was a local murder. It should have been handled by the Dallas Police Department, because in those days, there wasn't an actual law of killing the president. So it was a homicide that took place in Dallas, and they illegally removed the body, because Texas law says all homicides, the autopsy will be performed in Texas. Well, they took Kennedy's body and immediately put it under government supervision, and the autopsy took place at Bethesda Naval Hospital, done by two doctors who had never done an autopsy before.
Well, Governor,
imagine that. You got the President of the United States, and you got incompetent autopsy doctors that didn't do it. And yet all the doctors at Dealey Plaza at Parkland Hospital, many of them with combat experience, said the back of the president's head was blown out.
We thank you, Governor.
The bullet came from the front.
Let's talk again when the book comes out. We'd like that.
Very good, Jim. Always fun to do so. Keep up the good work, and thank you for giving me a forum, and wish everyone down in Louisiana well. I got to get down to that Bourbon Street again in the French Quarter. I love looking for antiques down there.
Okay. Well,
thanks, Jim.
Deal. Thank you, Governor. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now we're joined by John McGinnis, who occasionally is seen on Bourbon Street. Good morning, John. Yeah.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing, sir?
That's quite an act to follow.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I wouldn't try.
Well, you've spent 40 years covering the Capitol. Some would say it's hard to keep your sanity doing that. This was your 40th regular session, and this one was it was a bit tepid, but what were the most noteworthy things that happened?
Well, I guess the biggest moment was, in the first 5 minutes when the governor shelved his tax repeal plan. And after that, that just took the air out of the session. It didn't really have much any big ideas after that. It certainly wasn't what the legislature had come expecting to deal with. And after that, it just became a question of how do you balance the budget within the parameters that the governor demanded.
Well, they put a lot of Band-Aids on the budget.
It's not the first time.
And won't be the last.
Right. It's not the first time. But what I thought was interesting was that it was a bipartisan effort. You had this group of Republicans who called themselves the fiscal hawks, who teamed up with the Democrats, and that made for a majority in the House, and they were able to at least get some a more responsible approach to the budget. They use less one-time money for recurring expenses. And then they did not raise taxes, which the governor said he'd veto anyway. So, but it angered some of the other Republicans, but and upset the Senate. But I thought in the end it was a good exercise, and I think what we saw in this session, Jim, is probably kind of maybe the start of the lame duckhood for the governor, and the legislature kind of finding their own grounding of how to get things done without the governor guiding the way. It's not easy to do because our political system is kind of built on a strong governor. But in the absence, they figured out how to do it.
Well, in your latest Law Politics Weekly report, you call it governor in absentia. Can the governor take credit for what happened?
He tried. He called reporters Wednesday night and told them that they hadn't come to his office to announce that there was a deal on the budget. Even though the legislators who had told him about a few hours earlier, the governor, we still have to go back and talk to our caucuses. But he got out there and in effect took some credit for it for something he had not a whole lot to do with. And that angered the legislators a lot more on Wednesday night and Thursday morning. But I think they've come to expect that.
He held his ground on Medicaid expansion. Is this an issue that will stay alive, or is it gone for a while?
I think it's something that we'll be hearing more about in the U.S. Senate race next year. Of course, once we get into actually starting Obamacare, and the Affordable Care Act begins to really take effect in 2014, that's going to be a big issue in that Senate race. And anything that big, probably is not going to start smoothly. There may be a lot of problems with it. But that Medicaid expansion is always going to be a big issue. Especially also as you start having these community hospitals, private hospitals taking over management of the public hospitals, there's going to be a lot more financial pressure on them and a lot more calls to take that free money for now from the federal government.
How do you handicap the race right now with Cassidy and Landrieu?
Well, of course, Landrieu's always going to have close races. It will be a national race, more so probably than past ones, where the Republicans will you want to hang Mary Landrieu with being tied to Obama, and the health care, her vote on health care was seen as critical to passing it. So, depending on how people feel about the Health Care Act next year. That's going to be used as an issue. At the same time, Landrieu is going to be using against Cassidy that he opposes the expansion of Medicaid.
We'll be back with John McGinnis in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with John McGinnis of Law Politics Weekly. Just covered his 40th regular session of the Louisiana legislature, so according to my math, that would mean you probably started doing this on a regular basis around 1974, John.
1974 was the first time I really came to the Capitol, and back when we were publishing Gree-Gree back in the 1970s, and we would do our stories called The Best and Worst Legislators, and we tried to look at the Capitol and the legislature as something that was trying to give it the color of Louisiana politics, and it's something I've been trying to do ever since, kind of capture the politics as well as the policy of what goes on there.
Well, 1974, Edwin Washington Edwards would have been a man of 46 in his first term. Now he's soon to be a man of 86 and will father a child. I saw him the other day, and I told him he was 8 years away from the Guinness Book of Records. 94 is the oldest father all time. And he said, Well, how many have had children 63 years apart? And he might have the record on that one.
He may well.
Will there ever be another like him?
I don't see it. I don't think that was. I think we've kind of passed that time. It seems like politicians today are a lot more self-conscious. They're almost afraid of being colorful. And in the kind of the internet information age we have, you know, there's everything you said, everything you do is commented on. So I don't know. I don't think we'll. We got personalities out there, and not ones serving in the governor's mansion right now, but we do have personalities out there, and we will have more. But I don't think you'll be able to have a guy that can live the life that Evan Evers lived, and still be an elected official anywhere in the United States.
Well, one maybe the biggest personality right now in the state is the mayor of Baton Rouge, and he wants to be lieutenant governor.
Yeah,
you write about that in your latest piece. And
well, I say he's you know we've never had an African American that's never been elected statewide to any statewide office, and he said. But I think Kip Holden would have a lot better chance than anyone any other African-American has in the past. He does have a great crossover appeal. He is known pretty much around the state because he's been governor for a long he's been mayor for a long time, and he's a character. He, you know, he wears his costumes, and he's seen as an ambassador for Baton Rouge and for Louisiana. So I would the odds would still be against him, no doubt, but I believe he would be a pretty formidable candidate. In a crowded field, which I think we will have a crowded field for lieutenant governor, probably because we're going to have a crowded field for governor. It's going to just be some people have to be running for number two office. That a guy like Kip Holden would be a favorite to make the runoff, probably against a Republican, and then we'd have a real showdown.
We would indeed. Imagine if it's Kip against Billy Nungesser.
I've thought about that before. I woke up last night thinking about it.
Well, thank you very much, John McGinnis.
All right, Jim.
Always
take care, bud.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bob Lutz is with us. He held senior leadership positions at General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, and BMW over nearly a half century in the auto industry. He was vice chair of GM from 2001 to 2010. He's a best-selling author. A few of his other books have been right at the top of the list, including Guts, Eight Laws of Business, and Car Guys versus Bean Counters, The Battle for the Soul of American Business. His latest work is Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Well, Bob, you profile some people you've encountered through the years, some of them colleagues, others competitors, and I think the person who's probably best known to our audience is Mr. Lee Iacocca. You say that his name is an acronym for I Am Chairman of Chrysler Corporation Always.
Right, yeah.
What kind of a guy was he?
Well, he's obviously a fascinating individual, larger than life, brilliant communicator, very, very strong opinions, sometimes didn't listen as much as he should, could be very gentle and very nice, you know, take a sincere interest in your family life and help you with problems, but on the other hand, he could also be absolutely mean and brutal when the situation called for it, which, of course, is what leaders have to do. They have to be, to a certain extent, unsentimental and make the right decisions, even if they have to, fire a guy that they like very much. They have to step up to it and do it. So he was good at all those things. He was, but he had his weak sides, too. And that's why the book is called Icons and Idiots. I examine all of these well-known people that I served under, the strengths, but also some of the weird sides. And, of course, Lee had some. And I think it was primarily driven by the fact that despite all of the bluster and the bravado and the profanity and so forth, and other people have remarked this too, he had a very strong, insecure side. he wasn't quite sure whether he was worthy of all this. You know, he came from a very simple background, and I think there were times when he was pinching himself and saying, am I really the CEO of one of the largest corporations in America? And so a lot of times in social situations when he was around new people, he was a little shy, withdrawn, not at all what you'd expect him to be.
Well, as far as the qualities that make a great leader, I don't know if there's any rule book, because as you note, there are people with different personalities, but
right.
You've learned from people of all stripes, including a Marine Corps drill instructor.
Right.
How was this experience?
Well, that experience was an eye-opener and a life-changer, because I was 22 years old at the time, fresh out of high school in Switzerland, which I have to say lasts 13 and a half years, so it wasn't that I'd gotten put back that many times. But I came from a very comfortable Swiss upper-middle-class background. We always had servants and so forth, and all of a sudden here I was in boot camp, being screamed at, shouted at, had my head shaved, learned to scrub the urinals with my bare hands and sand. And it stood at attention for hours and hours at a time, only went to the bathroom when we officially had head calls. And an exciting sight was, we only had so-called 10-minute head calls, which was usually reserved for the larger stuff. 10-minute head calls, 85 recruits trying to use 12 toilets for the same purpose in 10 minutes. It made for a lot of constipated recruits.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, that actually isn't in the book, but it's just a little insight. But there was a lot of physical abuse. This was prior to congressional investigations. It was in 1954, right after the Korean War. And they used whatever means were at their disposal to make the recruits into people who were as emotionally hardened to a combat-like situation as you could possibly achieve without actually going out on the battlefield. And the way they did that mm-hmm. was just by employing emotional pressure and physical pressure. And, you know, 25%, there is a 25% attrition rate, and the 25% that attrit out of boot camp are probably people you wouldn't want to have near you in combat anyway. So it's a very effective training method, and the training and the discipline and the love of the Marine Corps and the values that are imparted in Marine training just stay with you your whole life. And I think every Marine, if you ask him, who is the most important person in your life other than your mother and father, they would immediately say, my drill instructor in boot camp.
Well, the experiences you've had range from people who are extremely well-known, like Lee Iacocca, to the Marine Corps boot camp soldier who was a man who most of us, I'm sure all of us, did not know. But what about another well-known guy, the CEO of BMW, Eberhard von Kuenheim? What kind of a guy was he?
Well, he was a strange duck, and he was intellectually brilliant. He was a Prussian aristocrat who had been a displaced person after the war. His father had actually died. He and his mother were initially captured by the Russians, and he got out and quickly made his way and was picked up by the Quandt family, who at that time owned 75% of BMW. And he was given a number of assignments, all of which he executed brilliantly. And at age 43, he was CEO of BMW. And I was 40. I was his executive VP of sales. He was not a collegial person. I think maybe his experience as a refugee and displaced person, living in a displaced person camp, made him very self-focused, very distrustful of others. So he didn't share information. He didn't share power real well. He did not trust his executive VPs like myself or the exec VP for engineering or the exec VP for manufacturing. We were all sort of, yeah, we were in charge, but he rarely talked to us. And he had a cadre of young MBAs that were specialized in these various functions. So in a way, he was a lot like Richard Nixon, including having a kitchen cabinet. So he wasn't very pleasant to work with, I will tell you that. He was very often would do stuff behind your back. And I mean, it was a highly unsatisfactory working relationship. But if you look, he was the world's longest-serving automotive CEO, and he transformed BMW from a tiny little regional automaker into a global powerhouse and did extremely well by the shareholders. So you have to rate him as one of the all-time greatest automotive CEOs. And after I left BMW to join Ford, and I became chairman of Ford of Europe, and he and I would quite frequently have lunch or dinner together, either in London or in Frankfurt or something. And as time went on, he mellowed, and I presumably became a little bit more mature, and we got along just fine.
Well, the book is Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership from Bob Lutz, and it is a fascinating ride with the people he has been associated with. And I think the overriding message here is even the great ones have their foibles.
Yeah, and you should judge them by the ultimate result. The most important quality of any leader, and we've seen some examples where that quality was absent, but the most important trait in a leader is integrity. If the leader does not have integrity, everything else is wasted.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Good to visit with you. Congrats on another fine book.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And in our remaining time, as we close out the week, we have Peggy Sweeney McDonald. And meanwhile, back at Café Du Monde was The Rage of the Christmas Season, her book, which celebrates food and culture in Louisiana. And this is the third anniversary. How many of these presentations have you had over the last 3 years, Peggy?
Well, we're going to hit number 40 on Sunday night for the third anniversary show at Bhutan's. And tonight, actually, I'm doing the 39th show for the Exchange Club Louisiana Texas Convention. So that's kind of cool. It's the first time we've ever done it, like, not officially for Meanwhile Back at Café Du Monde, but for a group of people that are celebrating a convention here in Baton Rouge.
So you have the seasoned veteran Paul Arrigo, the president and CEO of Visit Baton Rouge, as the MC Sunday night. So
he's one of our favorites.
Yeah, he's good. He's good. He can express his thoughts about culture and food in Louisiana like few other people. And this is something that has taken a life of its own. These gatherings have become quite interesting.
Well, and your story is in it, Life at Louis, you've done the show several times.
I won't be there Sunday night, but yeah, I have been to a few of the shows, and I always like talking about Louis, where I was just a few hours ago. But there are people from all walks of life in all corners of the state who have found a way to express themselves in ways that I find amazing, as far as their appreciation for Louisiana and our food primarily, which is one of the staples in our great state.
And it's so great that it all started here. You know, I've done the shows in California and a couple in Mississippi, but the Louisiana stories always shine bright.
Well, what's your favorite Louisiana story?
You know, I'd probably have to say Miss Leah Chase. You know, she's 90 years old. She still fries chicken at Dookie Chase every day in her restaurant in New Orleans. And I love her story about when President Obama came in to have fried chicken, and she served him gumbo first. And he reached for the hot sauce. This was before he was president. And she said, "Mr. Obama, nobody puts hot sauce in my gumbo." And she says, right from the beginning, I guess I had a falling out with the president of the United States the first time I met him. I just love that story. And she's just such, the grand dame of Louisiana Creole food. And it was such a privilege to have her on the show two times in the New Orleans shows, and then to be a part of her book. And her grandson's story, learning how to cook in Miss Leah's kitchen, is in the book too. So it's pretty special, you know, having their legacy as part of the Meanwhile Back at Café Du Monde legacy.
Did the president use the hot sauce?
Yeah, I think he put it down really fast. She reprimanded him, and nobody fools around with Miss Leah. When she tells you something, you snap to it.
Well, Sunday night, you've got a list of people who I'm sure many of our people who are listening are familiar with, and we don't have time to mention them all, but who are some of the highlights this Sunday at Bhutan?
Well, you know, we have a bunch of new people, but we also have Missy Cruz, who's Miss Louisiana, one of my dearest friends, and John Gray, Vonda Gray, who has Body Fit Pilates and who's from Brazil. Her story is
John and Vonda are not related.
No, not related at all. And we have my dad, Miles Sweeney, is finally going to be a part of the show, which I'm very excited he's doing his story. And we also have Kat and Sean Rivera, who are going to be in it, and Gabby from Brouhaha. It's going to be 6 o'clock. The doors open for dinner, includes dinner, and then the show at 7. So call Bhutan.
Well, we hope you have a great weekend. Robert Travis Scott will be here Monday. Until then, for Kevin, I'm Jim. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.